right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This week we have a doubleheader, Tazria and Mitzora. Okay, so before we begin actually reading from the Chumash into the biblical text, I want to make note of a phrase that seems to be gaining in popularity. And that is the title of this week's class, which is Check Your Privilege. Is anybody familiar with that phrase, check your privilege? No. It's like a younger, woke type generational thing. Check your privilege. Your kids would know what it is.
Well, like I haven't heard that. Maybe mine's our tweeter.
Like that? Say it again. If what?
If you're silver, then down, you know, delta.
Go.
No. Not exactly. That's also good. That's check your bags, because you're going first class. That's something else. Check your privilege means... Mike, tell us what it means.
Check your privilege, just be aware of how good you have it.
Right. So if somebody's in a situation, there's a conversation, and the discussion turns to poverty in certain communities, and somebody says, let's say, I don't know, a white male, says, well, just get a job. So the response might be, check your privilege. In other words, easy for you to say, you don't even realize how easy it is just to get a job, theoretically. I know it's not easy for anybody always, you know, all times to get a job. Hey, welcome. But somebody who, in a sense, takes for granted their place in life or their opportunities, not recognizing the gifts that they have or whatever and taking it for granted and then kind of judging others. So the message is, really, check your privilege. Like, I think it means kind of, I don't think it means check it like, oh yeah, I've got privilege. It means like check it at the door, kind of like leave it. Check it like, check it, bevakasha. No, that's the wrong thing, the check it. Check it means leave it, right? Leave your privilege. Right, come down from your pedestal. You know everything. You're living a privileged life. Like, let's get into the real world. So it's a common phrase, especially online or whatever. It's always like, yeah, check a privilege. That's like a common refrain. So we're gonna look at the Jewish take on privilege. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it something to be proud of? Something to be perhaps ashamed or wary of? Should we promote our privilege or check our privilege? These are some of the questions we'll address tonight. First, let's discuss juxtaposition or the order of the Torah portions in the book of Leviticus. So please open up your Chumash to page 698 and 699. That is where you find the first of the two portions this week, Tazria. So we have a double portion, once again, Tazria and Mitzora. And both are talking about primarily the laws of impurity, specifically with regards to Tzaras. What is Tzaras or Tzarat?
Skin,
a skin ailment. Good. What is it typically translated as?
Leprosy.
It's not exactly leprosy. So Judaism teaches that that while leprosy is a skin issue, tzarat or tzaras is the byproduct of seven sins. I don't know if it's the seven deadly sins. That's a different conversation. But it's seven sins, seven, I don't know, mistakes, seven missteps that can lead a person to get tzaras back in the day. Today, we don't have this tzaras thing because we're not as pure as we used to be. Used to be, a person was pure. So if they did something wrong, it showed up in the skin. But today, you think it shows up in the skin?
It's all, everybody
would have it. Yeah, it's not only everyone would have it. It's like if something is pure and there's a little bit of impurity, so you notice it. Like, if you have a diamond that gets mud on it, so you notice it. If you have a coal that gets mud on it, like, yeah, it's par for the course. Like, it's not even significant. So back in the day, there was an inner purity. And so any type of indiscretion, or these seven types of indiscretions, so it would show up in the skin. It's like somebody who eats healthy, if they eat something unhealthy, like maybe it'll show up on the skin also, like literally on the skin. But today, so spiritually, we're not as great as they used to be. We have our own advantages, but not, we have our own privileges, but not necessarily on that level as Amalekut Zaitin, as you know, back in the day. And therefore, the indiscretions don't necessarily show up in the skin. It's not just skin deep, it's actually a little bit deeper. The negativity is already inside, unfortunately, so it doesn't show up in the skin. Anyway, we don't have tzaras today. We don't have the purification process, certainly, because that involved a priest and a temple and all that stuff, which we don't have. Okay. Nonetheless, we study it each and every year. We study it because it's in the Torah. And if it's in the Torah, it means that it has a lesson, a relevant, timely, timeless, personal message for you and I. If it didn't, it wouldn't be here. Torah, by definition, is life manual. So if you're not getting life instructions from Torah, read it again, you'll get some. It's like, it's user error. It's us not reading it right if it's not resonating and guiding us in life. But that's what Torah is, it's guidance. So if you're reading it as some ancient ritual regarding some leprosy type skin ailment, and a fellow who goes to a priest, and they do some stuff, and there's a bird offering, and they dip the bird in blood, and they send it off, or whatever, and that heals this, that's a thing, and that heals the metzora, the one who has leprosy, and that's an interesting thing that they did back in the day. If that's all it means, then we're not doing it right. It has to mean something for us today. So tonight, we're going to explore maybe some of the pertinent, relevant, timeless, timely life messages from these Torah portions. So Tazria and Metzora both speak about tzaras and the states of purity and impurity. Now, last week's Torah portion, Shmini, this is where the juxtaposition comes in. So last week, the Torah portion of Shmini, the second half, the latter part of the Torah portion, discussed the laws of kashrut, the laws of kosher. Our class last week focused on the kashrut, or lack thereof, of the snake and what that means spiritually. But here's what I want to focus on. The last part of the Torah portion deals with not only the animals and birds and fish that we can and cannot eat, consume, but it also tells us, the Torah also tells us, which animals are pure, tahar, and which are impure, tameh, which render a person, by contact, in a state of impurity, tameh, which back in the day was a big deal. Right? Y'all were just in Israel. If the temple was standing, you would have been making a pilgrimage, not just to the Holy Land, but to the Holy Temple within the Holy Land, probably. And you couldn't go there unless you were in a state of purity. And so knowing what constitutes, which animals, which types of living creatures create a state of purity and impurity, certainly a very germane, a very relevant topic to know back in the day. As we'll see, it's relevant today as well. The Torah tells us, though, which animals are pure and which ones are impure. Seems to be a correlation between the kosher animals and purity and the not kosher animals and the state of impurity. So let's begin. Ray, please start us off. Not on 698, turn back the clock or the page to 696, 697, as the Torah summarizes the last paragraph of last week's Torah portion. The Torah summarizes what we just discussed over the last series of verses. Ray, please take it away.
The explanation, is that
really? No, where it says the above in the Chumash. You see 697, the above?
Thank you. The above is the law regarding animals, birds, and all living creatures that move in water, and all creatures that creep on the ground, to distinguish between the ritually impure and the pure, between the animals that may be eaten and the animals that may not be eaten.
So here you have the Torah summary. This is the law about the animals and the birds and all living creatures. And the Torah says we've now distinguished between what is impure, tameh, and what is pure. What can be eaten and what cannot be eaten. Okay. And that's how it ends. Then we move into this week's Torah portion. And we talk about not animals, and not birds, and not fish, and not creepy crawling things, and not things with multiple legs, and not centipedes, and not snakes, and not grasshoppers or locusts. But we talk about in Tazria Mitzora, who do we talk about? Human beings. And we talk about their state, human states of purity and impurity. And the question is, why did the animals come first? Why, when discussing the laws of purity and impurity, why is it that the Torah decides, the Torah chooses to place the laws regarding the animals and their respective pure and impure states before it talks about the human being in his or her pure and impure states? Why? Why first the animals? Mike, you got something. Go.
One, you can take it two ways. One, that you claim you were created last. The gnat was created before you were.
Nice.
Not so important.
Good.
You know, or you can take it the other way. That Hashem created all those things so that when man was the penultimate result, and that's all for man.
Good.
Everything
Let's.
Created before.
Huh?
Everything created up to that point was all.
Setting the stage.
Man.
Good. So what you're saying is what the Talmud says. Which we have a text for. But before we get to the Talmud, let's... What is it? Oh, nice. Look at that. That's good prep work. But before we get there, let's look at Rashi. Because the opening... Rashi's opening comment on this week's Torah portion, the first Torah portion of this week's double portion, the opening Rashi quotes a rabbi who addresses this very question. So let's go to the Torah studies. Yeah, let's go to the Torah studies text. Amy, do you have a copy?
Oh, yes.
Please pass one down. Oh, you do have one? Enough for everybody? Everyone's got? Okay. So, Mike, please open up the Torah. Well, everyone should open up the Torah studies booklet or the book. To page number 27, text number 2. Here we have Rashi's comment.
Rabbi Simle said, just as the human was created after all domestic animals, wild beasts, and birds, so too the laws of human purity are stated after the laws about the purity of domestic animals, wild beasts, and birds.
So Rashi says, and he quotes a rabbi, Rav Simloi. Well, in the Hebrew it's Rav Simloi. Rabbi Simloi. Okay, Rabbi Simloi is fine. Rabbi Simloi. And he says, why is human ritual purity and impurity law stated after the animals? Because that follows the order of creation. So if you look back in Genesis, Bereshis, so in creation you have the same dynamic. You have the animals created, and then you have the human being. So he says, just like in their Yetzirah, just like in their creation or formation, you have the animal preceding the human being. So too in their laws, so too, I don't want to misquote him. Keshem shi yitzirato, just like their formation, in their formation, animals precede humans. Kach Torah so too their Torah, their law, with regards to purity and impurity, is likewise, the animals are likewise stated before the human being. Okay. Does this answer the question?
No.
No. What does it do?
It just states a parallel, but I don't see the...
The fundamental, the core question is, why animals first? And we said, well, it's not the first time. Does that answer the question? Right? Why are you hitting your brother? I hit him before. Have you answered the question? This is not okay, right? If it's not right, it's not right. If humans should come before animals, don't tell me that that's the way it was. Address the question. Yes? Now, Mike already addressed the question, which is good. But let's understand how we're getting there. So, again, the question is, why is the halacha, why is the law of ritual purity and impurity of animals stated in last week's Torah portion first, and then only human beings, the laws of tzarat stated in this week's Torah portion later, so first animals, then humans. Rashi quotes Rav Simloi to say, It's because it follows the order of creation. Creation also happened in the same order. To which we're asking, so I want to ask a few questions. Number one, you're not answering the question. You're deferring the question. You're saying, well, blame someone else. Blame Genesis. Hey, we're just following the precedent. We're just following protocol. Come on. Really? Address the question. If Rashi's asking the question, give us an answer. Don't just give us a parallel. Give us an answer. Number one. Number two, and this is the second question you can only ask when you've learned enough Rashi's to be dangerous. When you learn enough Rashi's, you realize that he has a pattern of how he writes his commentary. And there are certain things that he does, and certain things that he doesn't do, and certain things that he usually does or doesn't do, and then he changes it, and then you're like, why did he do that? I know I'm speaking super vague, but I'll be very clear right now. Rashi typically does not quote the source. He doesn't. In his commentary, he does not quote his sources. He just gives you the commentary. He just says, this is what the word means. This is what's going on in the narrative. He'll pull from Medrash, from Talmud, from Agat. He'll pull from anywhere. He doesn't tell you where he pulls from. Now, you have most modern editions of the Chumash with Rashi will tell you in the footnotes, for example, the Gunei Chumash, right? The Chumash that we're using right here. So if you look at Rashi, Rashi is the text underneath the Hebrew Chumash text itself. Rashi is printed in what we call Rashi font or Rashi script. It's a little bit different than the typical Hebrew square letters. You'll notice that you have 1, 2, 3, 4. You have footnote, little footnote superscript, I think they're called. Superscript numbers. And that signifies to look below at the bottom small line of the page. And you see there on the Hebrew side, one, from right to left, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the first quote, and these are references. Vayikaraba Yudalit Aleph, Talmud Tractate Nidachav Zayin Amabes, Devarim Deuteronomy 1:46, Bereshis Genesis 13:18, Taurus Kahanim, which is a Medrash on Leviticus, etc. So you have the sources on the bottom. Rashi didn't quote sources. But not only, he just gave you, the information. He's not writing a long-winded thing. Now, in addition to that, Rashi typically doesn't quote the author of a particular saying. You with me? Rashi doesn't go around saying, this explanation comes from Rabbi Yehuda, this one comes from Rabbi Akiva, this one comes from Rabbi Shmuel, this one comes from Rabbi Meir. He doesn't usually say that. In fact, if you look at all the Rashis in these two Torah portions, I don't know that you'll find another one that's attributed to another rabbi, except for the first one. Amar Rav Simlai, Rabbi Simlai said, do we need to know who said it? How does that help us I was about to ask a question, and then I realized that it's predicated on a premise. And the question I was about to ask is, how does that help us understand the explanation? Because if it didn't, he wouldn't quote the name. You with me? Everything that Rashi writes is a clue, is an exposition, is an explanation. If Rashi here chooses to include the name of the rabbi who taught this teaching, it means that it's relevant to our full understanding of the statement itself. You cannot understand the statement, this statement, without understanding the author. So now let me put these two points together, and we'll weave a narrative. We'll answer the question without giving any answers at all. You ready? Our first question is, Rashi doesn't seem to be giving a sufficient explanation. Our second question is, why does he quote the source? And the answer is, the second question answers the first question. You with me? No. There is. 1 second. The first question is, Rashi seems to be giving an insufficient answer. He's just kicking the question down the road. Why animals first? Because that's how creation was. But why? That's one question. Second question is, why does he tell us who said this, Rabbi Simlai? What I'm saying is, the second question answers the first. Once you know why Rabbi Simlai is significant, then you'll know why this was a full answer. And that's why Rashi didn't have to explain further. In other words, he explained, I gave you the answer. I'm not just kicking it down the road. I'm telling you why animals first, because it's Rabbi Simlai that said this. But how does that answer it? Okay, that's why we have, thank God, another 35 minutes. Everybody understand the structure first before we explain it? The structure. This way of studying Rashi was a hallmark of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe took what many consider to be, Rashi is so simple. Rashi is like, you don't study Rashi. Rashi is like Pshutei Shel Mikra, the simple explanation. The five-year-old that studies, why five-year-old? It says in Pirkei Avot, it says in Ethics of Our Fathers, it says that when a person turns five, when a child turns five, they can start studying Torah, the Chumash, the stories of the Torah. So Rashi says in his introduction to his commentary that he's writing this for the novice, if you will. He's writing it for the Ben Chamesh HaMikra, the five-year-old who's studying. There's a simple explanation. You want deeper stuff, mystical stuff, allegorical stuff, halachic stuff, other commentaries. I'm going to give you the simple meaning of the text. So if you're teaching a five-year-old, you need to know what the words mean, and you need to know how the narrative flows. That's Rashi. You got it. Simple, straightforward. That's how everyone understood Rashi. Until the Rebbe came along and took a Rashi like this and ripped it apart and said, you understand Rashi? You have no idea what Rashi's saying. This is Rashi? Rashi's giving you a half answer? Rashi's suddenly quoting Rabbi Simlai? Why? Because you don't know, because you didn't learn Rashi yet. Until you have the Rebbe's explanation on Rashi. The Rebbe took Rashi's that everyone studied for Rashi lived 800, 900 years ago. People studied for centuries. Yeah, simple. Rashi's giving a simple thing. The Rebbe ripped it apart. The Rebbe would give Rashi sichot. He would talk about Rashi. He would ask a dozen questions on Rashi. By the time he got done with the questions, you're like, how did I ever understand this thing? How did I ever think that I understood this Rashi? It makes no sense from beginning to end. Nothing about it makes sense. And then he would reconstruct the Rashi, put it back together, and you walk away thinking, wow, Rashi is unbelievable. And then the Rebbe would show you how Rashi, although he speaks on a simple level, he's hinting to the halacha and to the law. And he's hinting to the Kabbalah, to the mysticism of it, embedded in Rashi's words. And you walk away thinking, wow, Rashi's amazing. So we're going to do a little bit of that tonight. We're going to deconstruct the Rashi. We already started doing that. When I say deconstruct, I mean question it to the point that it now doesn't make sense. And then put it back together to demonstrate how not only does it make sense, but it's exquisite and it's incredibly structured. In fact, from the Rebbe's talks and analyses of Rashi, there was a book compiled called Kolole Rashi, which means the laws of Rashi. So if you ever want to study Rashi, like from the original, so you need to pick up a copy. It's a slender volume called Kolole Rashi, the rules of Rashi. How does Rashi come? How does he operate? One of the ways he operates is he doesn't quote sources unless it's instructive to understand. That's what I mean by the laws of Rashi. So, we have two questions. Let's summarize and let's move forward. The summary is as follows. The Torah discusses the laws of purity and impurity of animals in last week's Torah portion and then proceeds in this week's Torah portions to discuss that of the human being. The question is why first animals and then human beings? Rashi addresses it. He quotes Rabbi Simlai and he says, the reason why humans come secondary to animals, why they come after the animals, is because that's the way they were created. To which we asked, number one, why? And number two, why Rabbi Simlai? Make sense? Yes. Yeah, we're going to do that exactly tonight. We're going to precisely do that tonight. We're going to analyze the biography of Rabbi Simlai and then discover from the bio of this rabbi why it's, number one, relevant that Rashi quotes him, and number two, how that answers any remaining questions we might have on the commentary itself. So let's jump in. Let's jump into the actual explanation. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is quote the Talmud. The Talmud addresses the first question that we have. The first question that we have is, why indeed were animals created before human beings? And here is what the Talmud says, Tractate Sanhedrin, text number 3. Mike, did you read? You read. And we're up to you, text 327 in the Torah Studies text.
Another answer, and it might be directed to the banquet, but matter may be compared to a human king who built a palace, furnished it, and prepared a banquet. Only then did he usher in the guests.
Okay, so here we have two explanations the Talmud cites for why human beings come last, after the animals. Number one, if a person ever becomes too haughty or arrogant, so we remind the person, yeah, you think you're so, such, whatever, you think you're so amazing. Seriously. Even a gnat was created before you. Who do you think you are? The second explanation is that God set everything and prepared everything, and then the main characters walked in, Adam and Eve. So God set everything else up, prepared the banquet, set the tables, put out the food, right? Put all, they got the decor going, got the music going, got the lights going, and then you can come in now, it's ready for you. Now, these two explanations, could it be more different than each other, right? One speaks to the lowliness of man, the human being, and the other speaks to the greatness of the human being. One says, you think you're amazing? Come on. Even the now was created before you. Don't take yourself too seriously. The other one says, don't take yourself too seriously. Of course you should take yourself seriously. You're the apex, the pinnacle of creation. Everything is set for you. You couldn't get two more opposite expositions found in the same Talmudic, on the same Talmudic page. And so it's been said that this is a reminder. Whatever you need to hear, we have it. If you find yourself becoming too proud and arrogant, and your ego is running away with you, you're running, you know, your ego is too big. So then you remind yourself, "Afilo yitosh kadmach." Even a gnat came before you, before me, right? If we need to remind ourselves, or maybe others, right? So we say, "Don't forget about the gnat." What gnat? Before you, the gnat beat you, right? Even a gnat is higher; it precedes you. Don't take yourself too seriously. So if you need to hear something humbling, you got the first answer. If you feel down and depressed and low and insignificant, what does it matter? I'm so small. I'm just a tiny collection of atoms or whatever it is in this vast universe. Who cares what I do? It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. If you're ever feeling low, you're low. Everything was set up. This entire universe was created just for you. All of the trillions and gazillions and whatever's beyond that even. Oh, gazillions aren't even a word. Whatever. All of that that's out there that you look starry-eyed and say, wow, it's so big, you should know that everything was set for you. You're the main character. You're the main character. So what do you mean you're tired? You don't want to get out of bed today. There's nothing to accomplish. Everything is here waiting for you. You're the main character. It's like the mother comes into the kid's room and says, the child's room and says, she walks into her son's room and she says, you have to go to school. I don't want to go to school. You have to go to school. I'm too tired. You have to go to school. Everyone's going to wonder where you are. I don't want to go to school. She says, but you have to. Why? Because you're the principal. Let's reflect on that joke for a second. Right? So the point is, when you know that you're the principal, you know that you need to be there, so then you show up. Do what I can. Anyway. Yeah, you're with me so far? So it's been said that we should all carry these two pieces of paper in our pocket. One, even the gnat preceded you. Take it easy. And the other one, everything is set for you. Take yourself seriously. And depending on what you need that day or that moment, are you feeling down? Lift yourself up. Are you feeling a little too up? Knock yourself down a little bit. So although these two answers seem to be contradictory, you can call it contradictory, I'll call them complementary. And they complement whatever is whatever message you need to hear at that moment. Make sense? But today we're going to look at this a little bit differently and say the following. It's not two different times. Sometimes you need an ego check, a reality check. Sometimes you need to be uplifted and feel empowered. But rather, it refers to the critical position that a person stands in. And I'll explain what I mean. The human being created last signifies that the human being, as was said in the Talmud, the human being, everything is set for the human being. Which implies that there's a major role that you and I play within the purpose of creation itself. So when we get it right, then we say, everything's created for you. When we get it wrong, we say, oy, that's really wrong. Even the gnat is higher than you. So let me explain this. The human being, by virtue of our power, and the fact that we have free choice, and the fact that we have all the tools that we have, and the abilities that we have. So the human being stands to elevate all of creation, like nothing else can. Everything is set for the human being, lift it up. Was it at a Torah studies class that we discussed the idea that everything exists to ascend higher? I think that was last week. Everything exists to ascend higher. And the human being has the role to not just lift ourselves, him or herself, higher, but the human being is tasked to lift everything up, from the bottom up, from the lowest all the way up. And the example that's used in Kabbalah and Chassidus is, if you're lifting a building, then you don't lift it from the middle because you won't get everything. You have to lift it from the bottom. So the human being has a soul that's the highest, higher than any other soul in creation, is the human soul. The human soul comes from the essence of God. But the body of the human being is the lowest body, lower than all the other animals. How do we know that it's lower? Look back at Genesis. Every other creature that's created is created alive. It's only the human being whose body is created dead. And only subsequently does God breathe within Adam the breath of life. Which means there's a moment where the body is not alive, even as it's formed. Whereas all of the other creatures, their form, their body form, comes into being simultaneous with their spirit, with their life. So the body itself, the body of the human being, is the lowest of all bodies, of all physical bodies. The soul is the highest of all spiritual souls. The purpose of the human being is to reach down from the bottom and lift it up. It's like a 7-layer cake. You grab a 7-layer cake from the middle, you're going to get about 3.5 layers, my friend. Hey, I'm the first. I hate to be that guy, but this is important stuff. You want all 7 layers? You got to get in from the bottom, my friend. You got to get in from the bottom. This is the role of the human being. So here's the interesting thing. That's if all goes well. If we make the right choices in life, then everything gets lifted. Right? We take the energy that we have and we're praying and we're doing mitzvahs and we're studying Torah and we're all that good, all the good stuff, everything's being elevated, everything's ascending. And we're the ones lifting up. We're the lever on the bottom. We're lifting everything up. That's when it goes well. That's when we're doing what we need to be doing. And what happens when we fail? It's not only like missed opportunity, it degrades everything. And here's why. Something that doesn't have a lofty potential, for it to not live up to that potential is understandable because it didn't have that potential. But something that had potential and doesn't live up to that potential, it's a waste. It's a waste of a tremendous opportunity. So a child that the child pushes him or herself really hard, the highest they can get is a B. They're not shaykh to an A. They're not. It's not practical to expect an A. They're not going to get an A. But if they really work hard, they can get a B. So that B is a success. But what about the child that has the potential to get an A who gets a B? It's not just, oh, it's a B. We're happy with the B. It's a missed opportunity because you can get an A. The human being who acts like an animal, not making wise choices, I'm not animal bashing, by the way. I'm just saying that animals may not have the same type of wisdom to make wise choices as human beings, to override instinct in nature. Human being has that ability. A human being that chooses not to exercise that capacity of mind over emotion, mind over heart. A person who chooses rather to degrade themselves, so that person is not on the level of an animal. That person is lower than the animal, the Alter Rebbe writes in chapter 29 of Tanya. The human being who chooses to engage in animal-like activities is lower than the animal that he or she is emulating. Why? Because the animal had no choice in the matter. You had a choice, and you're still choosing to be an animal. That's lower than the animal. Make sense? Sort of? Kind of? Yes? Exactly. There's nothing wrong with the animal being an animal. Yeah. For an animal to be an animal, it's a good thing. For a mensch to be an animal, it's degrading. So we say it like this. As long as we're lifting the things around us up, as long as we're moving in the right direction, then everything is set for us. Second answer to the Talmud. Life is designed for us to make the grand entrance and lift everything up. To nurture the garden, to watch the garden, to cultivate the Garden of Eden. That's what Adam and Eve were tasked to do. And we pretty much have the same job. To take care of things, to tend the garden, God's garden, to lift things up and to improve it. That's our task in life. Not just physically, but spiritually. When we don't do this, then not only are we losing our human potential and going back down to the level below us, the level of animals, but we're actually lower than the animal and lower than the lowest animal. And you know why the gnat? I think it's mosquito. I don't know what gnats do. What do gnats do? What else? Do they bite? Do they suck blood? Okay, so it's mosquito. It has to be mosquito. Because it says, what does the Yiddish do? It's machnes ve'ine maitzi. It only takes in, it doesn't give out. It only takes but never gives. How rude. You only take and you never give back? That's what says the Yitesh does. Translate as gnat. I don't know if, I know mosquitoes, they typically just take your blood. I've never seen a mosquito like, I don't know, leave money or anything else. Or leave, I don't know, what would be helpful if they left? I don't know. A voucher? I don't know what my expectations are, but I'll tell you this, that every time I've had a mosquito around me, they've only tried to take stuff, never contributing, just taking my blood. But that's not a fault. That's the nature, and that's how God created the Yitosh, gnat/mosquito. But a human being who takes and doesn't give is lower than the mosquito. Because you're making that choice. You could have been higher, and you're choosing to be lower, then it's lower than what you're emulating. I hope this makes sense. Okay. Therefore, the Talmud is telling us, not only should you put these two pieces of paper in your pocket and pull them out when necessary, when you're feeling either low or high, either too low or too high. But it's telling us the stakes of our existence. What is at stake? What is the difference between doing our purpose and not doing our purpose? It's the difference between being the hero that walks in to the set table, to the set stage, and lifting it up, or degrading oneself lower than the lowest of creatures, the one that's so selfish, it only takes in and doesn't give back. That's what's at stake.
Is that connected to what's so bad about anger?
Anger is bad on many levels, but I'm sure it's connected. Tell me.
Because if anger implies that you, you're not using your mind, you're letting your emotions get,
right.
get in charge, and you're...
you're not exercising your human...
you're gone.
Right. You're not exercising your human, your humanity, if you will. Yeah. Now, sold. I was just
$3 billion.
Yeah, you just bought the art or something. I don't know what you're saying.
I don't know if there's any. I don't think there's any connection here. But if you look at, I read something that the chuppah is intentionally there's. This idea that it's just the bride and the groom is this idea that it is the home that they make, it is the love that makes the home, not the possessions in the home. Okay, it's a nice midrash, you know. Okay, so if you use this idea of the set, the banquet, I was just trying to see if there's anything that connects the chuppah, because you've got these.
That's more the reception later.
No, but you know, like it starts with these two people in union, in
right.
marriage. I don't know. I'm just it's interesting that that this shelter is really just about this chuppah. God's presence, it's really just about, it's almost like you're going back to this idea of...
I think it's stripping it down and saying, look, everything is, the world is in your hands.
Yeah.
You have the power.
You have the power.
You're standing at that point, and either you're the hero, or you're lower than the villain.
Yeah.
You're not even the villain. Lower than the villain. Like, lower than the mosquito. No one likes mosquitoes. Am I right? Anybody like, oh, I love mosquitoes. Yeah. Like, oh, let me just let sitting water happen for a while. And they need them to study, but that's like a study thing. But yeah. Okay, so now we understand. So let me ask one question, and then we'll get to text 5. The question is like this. Based on our understanding now of the different roles that animals, let's say, and human beings play, which is a more difficult role to play? Which is a more difficult life to live? The life of an animal or the life of a human being? Which is trickier? Which has more room for error? Which has more room for grandeur? Human being. So the stakes are much higher with the human being. Right? It's like high level position here. Everything that you do, it's like, it's either like life or death on some level, right? It's like the stakes are high. The animal is like, the animal can't do anything wrong. The animal doesn't have free choice. So everything is fine. Everything is the way it's designed. But the human being, it's more difficult. Text number 5. Dan, I think we're up to you. Text 5, page 29.
Sages declared, in the beginning one studies for one's own sake,
Continue.
God gave the Torah in similar order. First the lighter subjects, then the more challenging subjects. The laws of animal purity precede the laws of human purity because it is easier to separate the impure from the pure animal than to maintain the purity of the human. This is because the animal is incapable of defying God's will, whereas the human is innocent.
So the Rebbe explains that in general, within Torah, we always go higher and higher and higher. The stakes get higher as we progress. It builds in intensity. And so he says that's exactly why the Torah discusses the laws of animal purity and impurity, last week's Torah portion, and then leads into the human discussion when it comes to animals. The Torah says certain animals are pure and certain animals are impure. Was that a choice? Even the impure animals, are they bad? No. That's how God created them. So the pure and impurity, it's a created state. So God distinguishes between one state and another state, but it's all by default, it's all how God created it. When it comes to the human being's purity and impurity, who creates that state? Who created the state of the tzarat, of the mitzora? Who created that spiritual leprosy? How did that come about? Through a choice of a human being to engage in negative behavior. And that choice resulted in a state of impurity. So that's not a default God created. There's nothing I can do about it. State of impurity. This is I'm choosing to sabotage my innate holiness, my innate image of God, and instead I'm going to gossip about the neighbor. That's what's going on. That's a choice. That is more difficult. That parsha, that discussion is a more difficult discussion. It's a more complex discussion. It's a more intense discussion than the discussion about an animal's purity and impurity. Make sense? Which is why the Rebbe says you have to build up till you're ready for it. So first we talk about the animals, and then we talk about the human beings. And it's the same reason why. In the order of creation, first animals were created and then human beings. It's for the same reason, right? Why animals first and then human beings? First you deal with the easier stuff, the default stuff. God's creating this animal this way, that animal that way. God's creating the animals. And then God says, let me make a human being. And the human being now has their own ability to choose. And they can either be high or they can be really high or really low, mirroring the purity of their soul and the baseness of their body. They can be either extreme. But it's on them. And that's the ultimate. The ultimate purpose is to set everything up until we get to a human being who can lift everything up. But with that power comes the ability to degrade everything down as well. And that's exactly the same reason why the laws of purity and impurity are discussed first for the animal and then for the human being. So the message of all of this is that despite the fact that a human being has a very low and base by its nature, body, and a capacity to fall down really low, the calling of the human being is to leverage the power of the soul against the body, or to work with the body, to lift itself, the human being, and the rest of the world, and the rest of creation, up with the human being, with that person. Correct? Yes, that's the purpose. The purpose is to take the soul and to lift everything up.
Actually lifting your body up?
Yes. It begins with that. If you're not lifting yourself up, you can't lift anything else up. Right? If you're not in control in a healthy way, you can't be in control of other things in a healthy way. In other words, the purpose of life, as now explained through this analysis, purpose of life is to take something that begins in a very lowly state and make it better and improve it and lift it to a very high state. So now we understand why Rashi introduces us to the author of this insight, Rabbi Simlai. To understand this, we need to look at One biographical note. Text 7A. Mike. Text 7A, page 31. The Talmud tells a story about Rabbi Simlai.
Rabbi Simlai approached Rabbi Yochanan and asked to be taught the book of genealogy. Rabbi Yochanan, where are you from? Rabbi Simlai, from Lod. Rabbi Yochanan, and where do you currently reside? Rabbi Simlai, in the Hagah. The Hagah. Rabbi Yochanan, we do not teach Lodites nor the Nahardians. We certainly cannot teach you, for you are both a Lodite by birth and a Nahardian by residence.
Talk about getting shut out of the conversation here. All he wants to do is study this Sefer Yuchsin, this book of genealogy, the book of Yichus, which is, you know, like lineage, book of genealogy. And the rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan, the teacher, says, yeah, he's, what's going on? Who are you? Where are you from? Lod and Arda, forget about it. No, not happening. Not teaching you. The question is, why? Why not? Like, what's, like, what was the red flag? Like, what went wrong in that conversation? Text 7B, Mike, please read one more. Rashi explains.
He intended to put him off. Another explanation. Lodites and Nahardians lack pedigree.
What does pedigree mean? It means yichus. They don't have that lineage. And so you're going to teach a guy without lineage the book of lineage? Doesn't make any sense. You teach pedigree people the book of pedigree. You don't teach someone without the Yichus the book of Yichus. You with me? Yes? Does it sound nice or not? It's not so nice. Seems not so nice. Huh?
Not so nice.
Not so nice. So he says, look, you're not from an esteemed family. So why I'm not going to teach you the book of esteemed families because you're not in it. So the implication is you have to be in it to study it. Like, that doesn't sit right with a lot of us. Our sensibilities. He's getting shut out of the conversation just because he doesn't come from a prominent family. And this was a book about prominent families. So, like, I can't study a book on Abraham Lincoln because I'm not Abraham Lincoln. I mean, seriously. Like, since when is that a thing? I have to, like... So, the Rebbe explains the following. There's two ways to get ahead in life. One way is to be born into it, and one way is to fight for it and to achieve it. So you have some people that are privileged by birth. Those are the people in the book, right? The book of lineage, those are the people in that book. The people that were born into prominent families with a prominent lineage and with the pedigree, with all that stuff. The royal families. So they're the privileged. Right, remember checker privilege? Those that are born with privilege. That's one type of person. And then you have others who were not fortunate or whatever to be born into a family of great lineage. They don't have the pedigree. They're not in the book. And they achieve greatness not by being born into it, but through hard work. They started off wherever they started off, and they climbed, they rose, they fought, until they achieve what they achieved. And so I'll ask you a question, which is greater? To be born into greatness or to achieve it on one's own? Which is greater? So you're going to say achieving. Is there an advantage of being born into it? So the way the Rebbe explains it is the following. Each one has an advantage. The greatness that one can get through the gift of birth or whatever might be a higher level than what the other guy can climb toward. You with me? In other words, it might be, even after the other one climbs and scraps and works and achieves, still might be higher. You're born into the royal family in England, right? That's it. You're done. Either in a good way or a bad way, I don't know. But that's it. You're royalty. You're never gonna climb and reach that. Okay, I know now there's an upcoming chasana, a wedding, and everyone's talking about this. Whatever, it doesn't matter. But typically, huh?
She's not gonna be royal.
She won't be considered royal?
A princess. Because she's
Interesting. Huh. Anyway, so the greatness that you can get. Right, so that's all right. So this, that works with this. So the greatness that you can get, the heights that you can reach through the gift, let's call it the gift, right? In other words, what you didn't work for. The gift might be greater than what you can earn. So the advantage of the gift is the level. No, I'm saying the degree of the greatness. And the advantage of working for it is it's yours. So the gift you have, and it might be greater, it might be more, it might be higher, it's not really yours. I mean, you got it, but it's you didn't work on it. And what you don't work on, you don't own. You can't own what you... It doesn't have the same type of attachment. But when you worked on something, you worked on and you put in the effort and you achieved, that you earn, even if it's a little bit lower. So there's a statement from the Talmud, a person would rather have one measure of their own versus nine measures of a handout, of a gift from someone else. Even though it's more. But each one has an advantage. There is a fundamental advantage of the privilege because the privilege might be higher than what the other person could ever attain. But the advantage of climbing is that you earn what you got. Rabbi Simlai was not in the book. Which category was he in? He was a scholar. He was I'm not going to say self-made man because that has I always use that as a negative connotation. Like, who do you think you are to be self-made? Whatever. But he was a person who achieved greatness in Torah on his own. It's not like he was born into an illustrious family of scholars and rabbis and sages and judges and leaders. That wasn't the reality. He was born into a simple family. And he put in the effort and he climbed the ranks and he studied and became a Torah scholar. So now he wants to study. Rabbi Yochanan says, I don't want you to study this book. You know why? Protecting him, Rabbi Simlai. Because he feared that if he would study the book, you know what he would say? These guys, all their greatness, it means nothing. Because they didn't work for it. You with me? He might look with disdain at the book that he was studying. And he might start putting down all those families that come from illustrious lines. You know, going back all the way to King David and King Solomon, whatever it is, wherever they could trace their yichus, their lineage. Say, oh, these guys, oh, they're all the big shots. Yeah, they didn't earn it. It's only because they're in the book. That's why they're big shots. So he might be judging other people in a negative fashion. So Rabbi Yochanan says, you are an innovator. You are a self-starter. You're someone who created something yourself. You don't need to look at this book. It's not for you. It may only cause you to judge others negatively, to start, and don't even go down that line. Don't even go down that path. Don't get involved with it. You do your thing. You do you, as they say. You do your thing. Live your life. Don't worry about that model. Rabbi Simlai is the one, this same Rabbi Simlai, who rose from, you know, simple status, rose up to become an illustrious scholar, someone who's quoted in the Talmud. Not many rabbis quote in the Talmud. Someone who's quoted in the Talmud. He is the one that teaches us about the role of the human being vis-a-vis the animal. And he's the one that tells us that why is the story of purity and impurity of the human being after the animal? Because that's the way it is in creation. In other words, it's because human beings have an advantage over animals in that animals can't choose. Animals are pedigreed, whatever they have. There's even a food called pedigree. Am I wrong? I'm not wrong here. It's the dog food, right? Okay. I know my dog food. Anyway, so...
You're ready for a dog.
I'm ready. Oh, no, I'm not ready. I'm theoretically... For the purpose of this class and this conversation, I'm ready. I'm not ready. There's not even a thing. Rabbi Simlai says, why does the story of purity and impurity of the human being follow the animal? Because that's what it is in creation. Why is it in creation like that? It's because of the human potential for greatness. Because the human being stands in such a vulnerable state, such a potentially low state, that reflects paradoxically the upside that the human being has. Because of the lowliness of the body, the human being has the capacity to lift it up from the bottom up, like Rabbi Simlai himself, who lifted himself up. So it's Rabbi Simlai who is the greatest teacher to tell us this insight. Why is the human being created last? To lift everything up. Why is the story of purity and impurity of the human being last? Because, oh boy, the impurity can be low, but the purity can be super high. It's Rabbi Simlai that fills in the blanks and teaches us what it means to work hard and to achieve. But we ask the question again. Is it better? Not is it better. What if somebody does grow up with a certain privilege? Should they discard it so that they can have the advantage of working hard? Should we indeed check our privilege? The answer is not necessarily. And for this, I'll finish off with a story. The Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, once offered a blessing for his grandson, who would later be known, he would become the third Chabad Rebbe, known as the Tzemach Tzedek. His name was Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And he wished, not the same name, but obviously different generation of our Rebbe who had the same name. He wanted to give his grandson a blessing to know the whole Torah. He wanted to download the Torah into him with a blessing, without any effort, on the part of the grandchild. I want to give you a blessing that you'll have a gift, you'll know the whole Torah. And his grandson said, no. No, thank you. Because he wants to earn it himself. And later on in life he said, I regret not taking the blessing. Why? Because had I taken the blessing, I could have started off all the way up here. And then, could have kept on climbing higher. So do we need to check our privilege to have the advantage of a Rabbi Simlai? Do we need to discard any advantage, any gifts that we've been given to have the advantage of achievement? We don't. We can build upon the gifts that we have to then achieve. So whether we can count and delineate and whether we can, what's the word I'm looking for? Whether we can articulate our gifts and say, wow, I'm so lucky. Or whether we cannot articulate our gifts and we might think, I wasn't given any gifts. I was given no advantage. Either way, the message of tonight's class is that with the right amount of work, we can achieve greatness. We can take a lowly body and lift it to the greatest heights. We can take a world that so often is submerged in lowliness and lift it up to an absolutely epic place. And it's through the work that we do. It's the product of the work that we do that makes that happen. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.